Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today John Feinstein. We will be discussing Mr. Feinstein's new book, Last Dance, Behind the Scenes at the Final Four, published by Little Brown, with an introduction by Coach K, Mike Krzyzewski. First of all, John, thank you for your time this morning, for appearing on the show.
My pleasure, Casey. How are you?
I'm doing great. When I read Last Dance, it really is a love affair with the NCAA tournament that takes us behind the scenes. And first of all, I'd like to congratulate you for your Edgar nomination for Last Shot.
Oh, thank you. That was a great thrill, obviously. My first attempt at kids fiction, and the book was very, very well received, and the Edgar nomination kind of tops it all off, so thanks very much.
And I'd also say I like to give the listeners a treat. And if you are the type of basketball junkie that likes Last Dance, I really think that no matter what age you are, if you read Last Shot, you're going to find out a lot about the NCAA tournament and about the integrity and the ethics of journalism that I think adults and young adults as well will like.
Well, thanks. It's ironic because obviously Last Shot is set at the Final Four and it's fictional and it's built around the story of two kid journalists who stumble into a plot to fix the championship game, and clearly that's a fictional plot, even though a lot of real people appear throughout the book: Jim Calhoun, Mike Krzyzewski, Dick Vitale, Billy Packer, and others. And then Last Dance is the real Final Four, without any plots to fix the national championship game. But as you said, it's kind of an anecdotal history of my 26 years of going to the event and all the people I've encountered, ranging from guys like John Wooden and Dean Smith to walk-ons and referees and committee members, and just trying to show people what goes on away from the three basketball games, because there is so much more to that week than those three games.
Sure. And John, one of the things that I like about Last Dance is we're about the same age, and I became a basketball junkie in 1970 at the Mideast Regionals when I watched Austin Carr and Artis Gilmore and Kevin Kuhnert and those guys play at the Mideast Regionals here in Columbus, and also Pete Maravich. I can remember 1970 was the year of Pete Maravich. And you give us a nice history of really where the NCAA tournament has become. And you take us back to 1968 when NBC televised the semifinals and the finals for the first time. And that's hard to believe today, isn't it?
Really is, when you think about it, what a huge television event it's become. But when Texas Western beat Kentucky in 1966 in the game that's now been immortalized in the movie Glory Road, that game wasn't on network television. It was syndicated, and if you lived in Columbus, Ohio, it was a question of whether one of your local stations decided to pick up the game, whether you got it or not. And it's interesting you mentioned 1970, because if you go back to that era, the NIT was still pretty competitive with the NCAA in terms of how much it meant to teams and players and coaches. And you mentioned that Maravich team, which finished fourth in the NIT. That year, Marquette, coached by Al McGuire, opted not to go to the NCAA tournament because Al McGuire was unhappy with the regional his team was being sent to. And he said, you know what, the NIT means just about as much as the NCAA. We'll go there and try to win. And, of course, they did end up winning that tournament. And that was when the NCAA passed a rule which said, if you're an NCAA member and you get invited to our tournament, you must participate. And that, along with the expansion of the tournament in 1975 to 32 teams and then ultimately up to 64 teams 10 years later, is what really helped build this event into the monolith it's become, and ultimately really killed the NIT as a major event in the eyes of most people.
Sure. John, what do you think Pete Maravich with the three-point shot? He averaged over 44 points a game all 3 years that he played. What kind of a scoring average do you think he might have had in today's game?
Mind-boggling, isn't it?
It is.
I think he probably would average more than 50 a game.
Yeah.
He shot on most possessions, as you know, because you're old enough like me to remember Maravich as a player, although he was a great passer. The problem was he had, like, no players around him at LSU. In fact, that senior year was the only year they made postseason play. Imagine having a player like Pete Maravich and not making postseason two of his 3 years. But, you know, I was thinking about that very point last night. I was watching Duke play Miami, and J.J. Redick broke the all-time scoring record at Duke going past Johnny Dawkins. And, you know, they made a big deal out of it, and it is a big deal. J.J. Redick's a great player, but Johnny Dawkins never had a three-point shot.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a guard. So you wonder how many points he would have finished with. You can wonder that with many great players and great shooters. You mentioned that regional you were at in Columbus. How many points would Austin Carr have scored in that game against Bowling Green that year when he went for 61?
Right.
If there had been a three-point shot.
Right, exactly. Exactly. In 1973, NBC took the championship game to Monday night, and they had the great fortune of having Bill Walton playing perhaps the greatest game ever played in a championship game. How important was that, do you think, to what eventually led to the 1979 game?
Critical. One thing I tried to do in the book, Casey, was because you asked the question that is the logical question to ask. You know, how do you get from 1967 when the national championship game isn't even on network TV to 2006 when every game of the tournament's on CBS and it's a multi-billion dollar deal and, you know, the whole country basically stops for 3 weeks to follow this event. And I think there were several seminal events. One was going to network TV, as you mentioned, in 68, and then the next one was that game in 73 when NBC decided to take the risk, move the championship game out of Saturday afternoon, which is when it was being played at the time, to Monday night in prime time, and Walton went off 21 out of 22, and his only miss was a tip-in against Memphis State. And that established the championship game as a primetime event. Then 75, as I mentioned, came the expansion. And the other key thing, well, there were two more. 1979, Magic versus Larry, still the highest-rated college basketball game ever played, Michigan State, Indiana State. That matchup, even though, as Billy Packer points out, it wasn't a particularly good game.
Mm-hmm.
But the matchup had such sex appeal because Indiana State was undefeated. They were the kids out of the small conference. You know, Bird was the hick from French Lick. And here was Magic, you know, who was, you know, so clearly gifted and had all these great players around him. And Michigan State dominated the championship game. And then, 3 years later, and this one's more, you know, everybody talks about Magic versus Larry and Walton, as they should. But this goes unnoticed, but I think it was a critical step. When CBS won the rights to the NCAA tournament away from NBC in 1982 by quadrupling the money from $4 million a year to $16 million a year. They were worried about putting their mark on the event because the face of college basketball at that time, as I'm sure you remember, was the team of Enberg, McGuire, and Packer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where they went, that was a big event. And Billy Packer was hired by CBS, and he and a producer named Len DeLuca came up with this crazy idea. Why not have a TV show where we unveil the brackets? It had never been done before. But before that, if you were Ohio State on the Sunday that the bids went out, you sat back and waited for a phone call from somebody in the NCAA office in Kansas City saying, okay, you're going to go to Dayton to play your first-round game against Alabama-Birmingham or whatever it might be. CBS, Packer, and DeLuca said, why not put the brackets up on national TV all at once? We'll call it the Road to the Final Four. And as you know, Selection Sunday has now become a national holiday.
Yes.
You know, we all sit around with our empty brackets. We speculate on who's in, who's out, who's on the bubble, who's off the bubble, who's the number one seed, where a team's going to go, how are they going to match up. And then we scream bloody murder when the brackets are unveiled and the committee comes up with their inevitable screw-ups. And then we start looking for the upsets. You know, who's going to be Bucknell beating Kansas this year? Who's going to be Vermont beating Syracuse? And it really, to me, has elevated the event in the eyes of the public to a level that it wasn't even close to before that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, can you imagine in 1981, NBC paid $4 million for the rights to the NCAA tournament? It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it really is when you think about it. And I also remember quite vividly that when the announcement was made that NBC had a three-year deal that was, they paid $12 million for 3 years. And they made this big announcement that now CBS was going to play $48 million for the next 3 years. And people went, well, they're crazy. They're going to just, you know, go in the toilet. They're going to lose money. This is a ridiculous amount of money to pay. And as you know, the current contract, which runs for 11 years, is worth well, I think it's $1.6 billion for
right.
the current contract with CBS and the NCAA.
Right. And that was billion for the listeners that are not
that
familiar
wasn't a,
with
that. That wasn't a miss. I was not misspeaking. That was billion.
Right, exactly. At what point in time do we start mentioning Mike Krzyzewski in the same breath with John Wooden?
You know, that's a tough question. Red Auerbach, who is friends with both John Wooden and Mike Krzyzewski, believes that what Krzyzewski has achieved in the last 20 years with 10 Final Fours and 3 national titles is comparable to Wooden's 10 national titles and 12 Final Fours. His point being that there's so much more competition today. It's so much harder to keep your players hanging around till they're seniors today. You have to win 6 games, whereas when Wooden, 9 of the 10 titles Wooden won, you won 4 games, and then the last year it was up to 5 games to win the national championship, only 2 to get to the Final Four, and Wooden never had to leave the West Coast for all those regionals that he won. So on that basis, Red says Krzyzewski's already in the same sentence. I'm not sure, and as you know, Mike's a good friend, and he wrote the introduction for this book. I'm not sure you can talk about anybody in the same sense with 10 championships. I don't care if you won 2 games, 4 games, 6 games, 8 games, 12 games. 10 times you ended up as the best team holding the trophy. Mm-hmm. And when you think about the fact that Adolph Rupp is next on that list with 4, that's one of those records that will never be broken.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think what Krzyzewski has achieved is extraordinary, again, given today's climate, given the fact that, you know, he goes to the national championship game in 1999 with a team that starts three sophomores and a freshman, and then loses 3 of those kids that year as underclassmen and comes back 2 years later and wins the national championship with a whole new group. That's today's era. That's the way you have to do it. So I'm not in any way denigrating what Mike's achieved. I think it's extraordinary. But I think when I start, you know, when you start the sentence with greatest college coaches, I think you got to start with Wooden. And then in the same paragraph, you pick the order. You've got Krzyzewski, you've got Bob Knight, you've got Rupp, and you've got Dean Smith. To me, they're all in the first paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Wooden number 1, and then you can pick the order after that, and I won't argue with you no matter who you pick.
Sure, exactly. Exactly. And then, John, if you would you tell us in Last Dance, there's some wonderful anecdotes that you tell, and if you would you just tell us that story about George Raveling, because that's the kind of information you get in Last Dance, I think, that might surprise some of the readers.
Well, yeah, George Raveling, of course, longtime college basketball coach. He was an assistant years ago at Maryland under Lefty Driesell and went on to be very successful at Washington State and Iowa and then Southern Cal, building all 3 into NCAA tournament teams, and retired, gosh, it's been 10 years ago now because of some health problems, but he still works for Nike. And when George was just out of college, he played at Villanova. He was down in Washington, which is where he grew up, in August of 1963, on the day that Martin Luther King was going to give a speech on the Mall at a big civil rights rally. And as he was walking around with a couple friends early that morning, someone came up to him and said, "Look, we need some big guys. George is about 6'5", and back then probably weighed a lean 220, 225, to escort Dr. King on and off the podium." You know, this is back in the days before all the assassinations and before terrorism, and there really wasn't much formal security around people like Dr. King.
Mm-hmm.
So they just went around and, you know, gathered up a bunch of big guys and said, "Will you help Dr. King get safely to and from the podium?" And George Raveling said, "Geez, I'd be honored." So he was one of the guys who was standing on the podium behind Dr. King when he gave his "I Have a Dream" speech. And at the end of the speech, Dr. King started to walk off the podium, and he left all of his notes, you know, from the speech sitting there. And George Raveling grabbed them and turned to Dr. King and said, "Dr. King, you forgot your speech. Do you want to keep the text?" And Martin Luther King said, no, I don't need it anymore. You can keep it." And George Raveling, who recognized that he'd seen something momentous, historic, and unbelievable that day, as I guess did everybody who was there, said, "Wow." And he kept it. And a few years ago, he was offered $6 million to sell Dr. King's speech, and he turned it down, and he said he'll keep it and he'll pass it on to his son someday. but he still has it in his home. He actually showed it to me years ago. He had it in his desk drawer at the University of Iowa when he was coaching there. That's how I first came to know about it.
Wow. That's a great
story.
Amazing,
isn't it?
That is. In terms of picking a year to write The Last Dance, 2005 was a beauty because the regional finals, three of the four games went into overtime, and then Carolina beat Wisconsin at the last minute.
Right.
And really, it's the finals were the semifinals. The games were not as compelling, but the
right.
final game, Illinois versus North Carolina, was a classic game. And Roy Williams, who had gone through hell by turning down the North Carolina job previously, you know, finally wins the game.
Yeah, and you had to be happy for Roy Williams, I think, if you're any kind of basketball fan. Me, personally, I was especially happy. I've known Roy since he was Dean Smith's third assistant in North Carolina, and there's a funny story in the book about his first national championship game in 1982 when he was an assistant at Carolina, and he had this superstitious habit of having a candy bar before every game, but he couldn't find a candy bar. The manager, he said, couldn't find a candy bar anywhere in the Superdome. So Roy went upstairs and went to a ticket taker and said, look, I'm with the North Carolina basketball team. Again, this is a completely different era in terms of security. I've got to go outside for a little bit. Please remember me when I come back because I don't have a ticket or anything. And the guy said, sure, no problem. Roy goes out, he finds a candy bar, he comes back, the ticket taker's gone. And it's a half an hour before game time, and the guy's standing there saying, yeah, sure, you're one of the North Carolina coaches. Sure, that's a nice story. And he's thinking, my God, I'm not going to get back in the building. Dean's going to kill me, although he would always think of him as Coach Smith.
Right.
And eventually somebody came along and said, no, I recognize that guy. I saw him on the bench Saturday. You can let him in. It's okay. But imagine what would happen if you tried something like that today with security the way it is.
But oh, yeah.
You're right about last year. I got lucky. I mean, I picked last year to do this book for purely personal reasons. My first Final Four was in St. Louis in 1978, first time back 2005 since then, and I thought it would be interesting for me to compare what the event was in St. Louis 27 years later as opposed to the first time I went, and it certainly was. But you're right, I got lucky with the games being the quality that they were, especially the final. But really, if you think about it, Casey, nowadays you pick almost any year, you're going to get pretty good basketball games and pretty good storylines.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And John, I want to, for the listeners out there, I'd like to switch gears for a moment here and talk about Caddy for Life.
Sure.
Which Little Brown published in 2004, Back Bay published in paperback in 2005. And you write, one of the things that I really admire about you is you write, it seems, with equal passion about golf, basketball, football, tennis, maybe tennis not quite so much, but the love comes through in golf, basketball, football. And Caddy for Life is the story of Bruce Edwards. And I read it last week. And I've got to tell you, it was a moving story on so many different levels. And I'm so glad that you wrote that book.
Well, so am I, Casey. And as you remember in the introduction, I mentioned that when Bruce first approached me, Bruce and I had been friends for 22 years. He was actually the first guy I ever interviewed at a PGA Tour event in 1981, there in Columbus at the Memorial Tournament. And we became good friends. And when he first approached me after he was diagnosed in 2003 with ALS and asked me about writing a book, my instinctive answer was purely selfish, which was, I don't want to watch a friend die from up close. I know this is going to be horrible. When Bruce had first been diagnosed, I had gone on the internet. You know, I knew what ALS was. I knew of Lou Gehrig's disease, but I didn't really know exactly what it does to you. And I went on the internet and looked, and it was, the description's horrific. And I thought, I don't want to do this. But then, in the same conversation, I thought to myself, wait a minute, this guy is A, your friend, B, this is a tragic story, but it's also a remarkable story, how he became really the king of the caddies, you know, someone who aspired in high school to be a caddy. Most of us would never aspire to that, but Bruce wanted to do that, and his relationship with Tom Watson, his friendship with him, the way he came back and found Marcia, his wife, after they had first dated in 1974, and 28 years later they get engaged, only to have Bruce be diagnosed 2 weeks later. And I'm very glad I did the book, because I learned so much from Bruce and from Tom about dealing with adversity, the ultimate adversity, and about courage, which is an overused word in sports, and about friendship and loyalty. And to watch Bruce go through it and with Tom at his side was heartbreaking, but it was also in many ways uplifting because, you know, it's corny to say it, but it taught me so much about the human spirit. And, you know, all that time I was with Bruce during that last year of his life, I never once heard him say, why me? I never once heard him say, this is unfair. And, you know, I'm someone who says, why me when I'm stuck in traffic?
Right.
And it really taught me a lot, and the response to the book was wonderful, and it looks like there's a pretty decent chance it'll end up being a television movie.
Oh, that's great.
In the next year or so, and obviously I'm thrilled about that. Bruce deserves that because he was, you know, a remarkable guy.
Well, John, tell us, too, the story about you had kind of made a commitment yourself that you were going to take some time off, and
right.
I think that speaks very highly of your wife. And tell us, if you would,
yeah,
what happened when Bruce Edwards asked you to do the book.
Well, my wife Mary is tries very hard to be my breaking mechanism. I love my work, as you pointed out, and I'm very fortunate that I get a lot of opportunities. But she is the person who often says to me, you know, the word no exists in the dictionary for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
We have two children, and I had said to Mary, I was working on a book on Red Hour back at the time, and I said I'm going to try to finish this up by the summer and take the summer off so we can, you know, have some time together and with the kids and no travel and all that. And when Bruce approached me at the Masters, as I said, you know, once my gut told me I needed to do this, it was the right thing to do. And I went back to the press room after my conversation with Bruce, and I called Mary, dreading the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I knew she was going to say, oh, John, come on, I know you feel terrible for Bruce, and I know he's your friend. And, you know, but good gosh, you promised you were going to take the summer off and blah, blah. And I called and I told her the whole story, just pretty much as I laid it out for you. And there was a silence on the end of the phone, and she said, you have to do this. Of course you have to do this. This is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I knew, you know, that my gut was right, that it was the right thing to do, because Mary, as I said, she's smarter than me, and she's my breaking mechanism. And when her gut said right away this was something that should be done, I knew it was something that needed to be done.
Good. And, again, I strongly recommend Caddy for Life. Just a beautiful story. And also Last Dance. And, John, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning. I know you're a very busy man. And I also wish you luck with your young adults. I understand you have another one coming out in August, Mystery at the U.S. Open.
Yes, U.S. Open tennis. The two kids, Stevie and Susan Carroll, the two kid journalists, end up at the U.S. Open tennis tournament, and a beautiful Russian teenager disappears en route to her first match, and they have to figure out what in the heck happened. And the book's called Banishing Act, and it was great fun to do, especially after the way the first one did it, did so well.
Yeah, good. And going into the NCAA tournament this year, it's kind of going to be a strange year, isn't it, with what's happening with Mike Davis at IU and some of the teams that have played competitively in the past not having good years. It should be a very interesting tournament.
Yeah, you know, it always is. That's what I've said frequently, Casey. That's the great thing about the tournament. The one-and-out nature of it makes it so unpredictable. And, you know, you look at Connecticut and think they probably have the best team, and Villanova and Duke and Texas are all very good, but Texas goes out and gets beaten by 20 last weekend. And
yeah,
you just never know, and that's why it's so much fun.
Yeah, exactly. Well, John, best of luck with Last Dance. I hope Caddy for Life ends up as a TV movie. That would be a great venue for it. And I look forward to talking with you down the road when your next book comes out.
Casey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.